to the second case this morning, Catherine versus the City of Evanston.
Good morning, Your Honors, again. My name is Irina Dmitrieva. I will present an argument on behalf of Amicus that was appointed by this court to argue the side of the appellants, plaintiffs here. Amicus respectfully asks this court to reverse dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction here for two key reasons. First, the Tax Injunction Act does not apply here because Evanston's demolition tax does not constitute a tax for purposes of the Tax Injunction Act, but rather it constitutes a regulatory fee designed to regulate behavior rather than to generate revenue for the city. And second, the plaintiffs established their Article 3 standing by presenting a competent evidence of the injury, in fact, a lost real estate sale.
Could we start with that first question? That
last Article 3 question, standing?
Please, the question of standing. Given the deposition testimony of the plaintiffs in the case, what really are their intentions right now? Are they going to sell this property? Are they going to apply for a demolition permit? Where does the record show they stand?
The record shows as follows. In the deposition testimony, Michael Catherine was asked if he was able to locate other buyers for this particular property since the offer from Mr. Uzen fell through, and he said no. There were no other potential buyers. And then it was followed with the question, so what are your current intentions? And he said no. My current intentions are in the air because there are no potential buyers. So the injury that plaintiffs claim here, that Amicus believes is consistent with the injury cognizable under this court's decision in Main Street Organization of Realtors, is the reduction in the saleability of property.
Reduction in the saleability. In other words, even if there are buyers out there who might purchase the land for purposes of, with no intention of demolition, still, the general saleability of the land is reduced because certain buyers will be discouraged.
I believe it's more broad than that. I believe that Mr. Catherine testified there were no potential buyers, period, for his property. I do not believe he was looking for potential buyers to demolish the property.
In other words, the general options for the use of the property have been diminished.
Yes.
Because of the demolition fee.
Exactly. And
therefore the general saleability or economic
attractiveness
worth of the property is diminished.
Is diminished, yes, because
yes.
The very property here was valued, you know, the agreed upon price, cash price, was not very high. Mm-hmm. It was in the lower level of $225,000. So if we speak about this particular property that's not on a very expensive site, it's considered an additional $10,000 a levy that the prospective buyer, you know, who would potentially would want to maybe replace this existing structure with a new one, would have to pay. It's an increase of 4.5% over the market price. So that's not an insignificant sum.
Now, count one, as I recall, is a request challenges the constitutionality of the TIA.
Yes, there is a count challenging the constitutionality of the TIA.
Does the same standing argument pertain to that count as to the others?
I was thinking hard and long about this, and I believe it's the same argument.
I'm injured because the saleability of my property is down, and I don't have this remedy available to me.
Yes, that's what I believe. And besides, just even logically thinking, when the argument that the plaintiffs are not damaged by the Tax Injunction Act that precludes the ability to assert their federal claims in federal court, it seems to be counterintuitive to me, because obviously it's well recognized in all circuits, and in this circuit in particular, plaintiffs have strong interest in their preferred forum to litigate their federal claims. And so by precluding them from this forum, there is an additional injury that they suffer. So my answer would be yes, it is the same injury, but there is an additional injury of that they cannot litigate the federal constitutional claims in the preferred forum.
Now, if the plaintiffs were to get to the merits of their claim with respect to the constitutionality of the TIA, What argument do they plan to make?
Your Honor, and this is one of the issues here, that's not what this court is asked, you know, to do, to address the merits of the claims.
I understand.
And the district court actually never looked at the merits of, the claim. And we, as you know, amicus, obviously did not address it in our briefs because the district court never got to the merits, never got to the merits of the claim because it dismissed all lawsuits.
And the injury, in your view, does not have to have any direct connection to the argument that is made on the constitutionality of the statute. In other words, their injury as plaintiffs does not have to have any kind of direct connection to the particular argument they're going to make on the merits of the constitutionality of the statute.
Well, I believe these matters are intertwined, and you know, defendants mentioned that case, the Gas case from the Third Circuit, the only other federal appellate case that addressed the constitutionality of the TIA. And in that particular case, homeowners in Pennsylvania challenged the procedure for appealing real estate assessments. And in the course of appealing that procedure, they also raised the issue of constitutionality of TIA. And the district court in that case went ahead and addressed the constitutionality of the TIA. So to me, that's very analogous. You know, the core injury that homeowners are addressing are the injury to their interest as homeowners, to the property interest that they have.
I suppose
they don't have to. They didn't allege any separate injury that, you know, because otherwise no one would ever be able to challenge the constitutionality of the TIA in federal court. I mean,
it could be raised as an issue in state court. And the injury has to be linked to the claim, and we evaluate standing claim by claim. And the property rights injury that underlies the substantive claims here against the demolition tax doesn't support standing to challenge the constitutionality of the Tax Injunction Act claim, at least the standalone Tax Injunction Act claim attacking its constitutionality. That's really a procedural injury case because, as I understand it, your argument is that the plaintiffs are being deprived of a federal forum to attack the constitutionality of the Tax Injunction Act, and that's a different sort of an injury.
Well, the injury, that's the core injury here, is the reduction of the saleability of property.
Right, so, and that supports standing for the claims that attack the constitutionality of the Evanston Ordinance.
Yes.
But it's not an injury that supports standing to challenge the
TIA.
But then
it seems to me that would be the only way to really attack the...
Well, after the Duke Power case, do you need to have that connection between the alleged injury and the argument that you're making on the constitutionality of the statute? Are you going to concede that there has to be that connection?
Could you please repeat your question?
Well, as I understand my colleague's question, there needs to be, she's asked whether there needs to be a connection between the injury asserted and the constitutional argument that you are making on the merits of the constitutional issue. And my question to you is, are you going to concede that is necessary, that there needs to be that connection?
You know, Your Honors, again, based on case law in my mind, I just see that connection. So, and by analogy to the Gas case, where the district court did address and the Third Circuit addressed it, I see that connection, you know, between that constitutionality and this Article 3 standing to address it, because the issues are intertwined. I do not believe there is a way to separate them. And that's the purpose of the Tax Injunction Act also, you know, to address the concerned of state property owners or taxpayers.
Well,
so any kind
let's
of
ask it differently.
Yeah.
Maybe frame the question a little differently. The relief that's being questioned or that's being requested in the count that pertains to the constitutionality of the Tax Injunction Act. Is that count one?
Yes.
That's count one. All right. What is the relief that's being requested in count one?
the relief that they request is to proceed in the federal court.
So you're not asking for a declaration that the Tax Injunction Act is unconstitutional?
That the Tax Injunction Act is unconstitutional, yes.
Okay.
That's the count one of the plaintiff's complaint that was added to declare that the Tax Injunction Act is unconstitutional.
Okay, yes. And the general rule is that you have to demonstrate standing for each form of relief that you're requesting. And if the form of relief that's being requested in count one is a declaration that the Tax Injunction Act exceeds Congress's power, I mean, is that essentially the argument that's being made here, that Congress had no authority to enact the Tax Injunction Act, which is a restriction on federal court jurisdiction? I mean, that's kind of an implausible argument
yes.
in the first place. But let's just assume that that's the argument for the unconstitutionality of the Tax Injunction Act. What injury flows from that, from the unconstitutionality of the Tax Injunction Act, other than a form choice injury, which is procedural? It's not a property rights injury.
Well, I guess it's the remedy of federal rights of property owners. The property owners would have...
You can get those remedies in state court.
That's true. And
concurrent jurisdiction.
I entered into my rebuttal time on the very issue that, like, really I wanted to address is the demolition tax ordinance.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead with that.
yes. Given the time, the demolition tax ordinance that is really the core, issue here, it's a regulatory fee, it's not a tax, because its primary purpose is to artificially control the real estate market in Evanston rather than to generate general revenue for the city. And $10,000 assessment on each demolition is only one part of it. The other part, what really creates a regulatory scheme is the system of exceptions and exemptions from that fee. To start with, not everybody who wishes to demolish the building have to pay the fee. If an owner enters into an agreement with the Director of Community Development Department of Evanston to offer affordable housing, that owner doesn't have to pay the fee. If the owner continues living for three subsequent years in the renovated building, that owner doesn't have to pay the fee. And if the owner replaces a building with what Evanston's Community Development Department determines to be an affordable housing, the fee doesn't need to be paid.
And this is a non-legislative body, as I understand it, that's making these determinations?
That is a non-legislative body that makes those determinations what constitutes affordable housing. It's the director of Evanston's Community Development Department that's given that authority.
And the assessment goes into a separate fund?
Goes into a special purpose, separate fund for a special purpose, and the purpose is not connected with essential municipal services, which basically distinguishes all the cases that defendants cite for their argument. It's not an essential municipal purpose. It's very laudable purpose to provide affordable housing and to preserve cultural diversity, but it's not the purpose of generating revenues for the city.
And the expenditures from that fund are also directed by this non-legislative body, is that right?
Yes.
So it doesn't come back to the Common Council?
The ordinance sets forth certain purposes for which funds from the special fund could be directed to, but it's the Community Development Department that has authority to actually make decisions where it goes. And we believe that there are very strong analogies with this court's decision in Hager, where the permit fee on heavy trucks was authorized by a city ordinance, but it was administered by the city manager. The ordinance was designed both to raise revenue for road maintenance and to control the weight of trucks, and the fee actually went to a general fund. And still, this court concluded that because the primary purpose of the ordinance was to regulate the weight of trucks, even assessments that have a public purpose, if they are part of regulatory program, they still constitute regulatory fees. And I see that I have only 1 minute left, and I really would like to reserve it for my rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. Ian Johnson on behalf of the City of Evanston and the City Council of Evanston. I'd like to address first an issue of the record as to what body imposes the tax and what body is involved in the administration of the tax. At the record at 90-3, which is the ordinance at issue here, section 4-22-2, specifically states that the City Council of Evanston imposed this tax. This is not a tax or a fee that's being imposed by somebody in the bowels of the Lorraine Morton Civic Center.
It is a social engineering plan, though, right?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by social engineering plan. It certainly is designed.
Yes, you do. It's an idea for wealth redistribution, or at least making sure that low-income people can also live in the same areas that have higher-income properties. Right?
Part of the goal is to provide for affordable housing within Evanston, which the City of Evanston, through its legislative body, has decided is within the general health, safety, and welfare of the citizenry of Evanston.
This is basically an anti-flipping statute, isn't it?
In part. There's an aspect to it that provides for flipping, that addresses that component of the process. But the ultimate goal of the ordinance was to raise revenue. And the revenue
has been very effective, hasn't it?
It raised $150,000, Your Honor. And you compare that to the $20 that was raised in Hager or the $0 that was raised in retailers, $150,000 is a lot of money.
How many, and this was off how many permits?
$150,000 off of 11 permits.
11 permits.
So it was $10,000 per permit, and then one particular permit addressed a multi-unit development. So there are four there. So
how was that money used?
That money is designed to go towards affordable housing programs, non-for-profits within Evanston that help people obtain affordable housing, that help homeowners obtain affordable housing.
Specifically, has it all been used, or is it still?
No, there's still funds left, in part because there's litigation going on, and when there's litigation going on and there's money, the city gets a little nervous about spending that money and then having to maybe possibly down the road have to come up with that money.
How do you distinguish our holding in the Hager case?
Hager's different on a number of levels, Judge. First, there are the specific admissions in Hager as to what the purpose of that ordinance was. The mayor in that case, at a evidentiary hearing, specifically testified that the goal of their ordinances was to regulate behavior, and that they only raised $20 with that ordinance, and they probably wouldn't even raise that $20 if the plaintiffs would have, you know, worked with them a little bit on the side.
Given all of the exceptions to the payment of the demolition fee your ordinance, aren't you basically regulating behavior?
There's
you stay in the house 3 years, you're off the hook.
I will tell you that I will admit to you that there is a regulatory effect, but the goal and the purpose is not to regulate behavior.
But in Hager, we said you look for why the money is taken as well as where it goes.
Correct. That is correct. And the ordinance at issue here, and what Hager says, is a look to the language of the ordinance and the circumstances surrounding the adoption of the ordinance. The language of the ordinance here specifically is the City Council imposing this tax to obtain funds, and they've obtained $150,000.
Perhaps you could help me out then with respect to this overall circumstances. In your brief, you made quite a put a great deal of emphasis on the fact that there is a state statute that, in your words, encourage this municipal ordinance. How does it encourage it? Is this some kind of a revenue sharing operation with the state? Is there some state benefit to be gotten if you have this kind of ordinance? That wasn't clear to me from reading the briefs.
Certainly, I'll address that, Judge. There is a state statute, the Illinois Affordable Housing Planning and Appeal Act, and it's administered by, not surprisingly, a state agency. That statute went into effect in 2004. That body identifies municipalities within the state of Illinois that do not have, in their view, under their statutory scheme, sufficient affordable housing. Essentially, they put together a list of those municipalities that have less than 10% affordable housing stock available within there. And so they will create a list of the municipalities that have failed to meet those guidelines under the statute. And then the municipalities can provide a plan to this agency saying, yeah, we're under the 10%, we're sorry, but here's the efforts we're going through to get to that 10%. So they file a plan. So that the regulatory body of the municipalities, this state agency, doesn't take punitive action against them. So it's this state agency supervising the affordable housing stock within the cities.
This sounds like a regulatory scheme to me.
For the state, that is, they are telling the municipalities, you need to have at least 10%. They don't say how you need to do it.
Right.
They just say you need to do it.
They're imposing a regulatory command on municipalities, and you're complying by establishing a local regulatory scheme that incentivizes certain or provides economic incentives to certain property uses. This is not a general taxation scheme by any of the standard measures for revenue-raising purposes. It goes into a special fund. It's controlled by a non-legislative body. The outflow of payments go to qualifying property owners who are middle income and will agree to use their property in a certain way. Even who the fee is ultimately imposed on is controlled not by the Common Council but by this non-legislative body, the Department of City Development.
Oh.
I don't know if I'm calling it the right name, but you know the Common Council doesn't decide which property owners pay it.
I'm sorry for interrupting. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Judge. In fact, the specific language of the statute provides that the City Council imposes the tax, and that's the issue.
That's just the enacting language.
That's
doesn't mean that each individual assessment is approved by the City Council, and as I read this, that's not what happens.
Then it goes to the City Manager has administrative functions.
Right.
However, the City Manager, which is the way Evanston administers property, it administers its functions, it's a City Manager form of government. The City Manager then implements these programs, but those programs have to be reviewed by the City Council's committees and then ultimately approved by the City Council.
Programs, but not individual permit applications and individual assessments of the demolition fee.
For each particular person, whether or not a citizen meets that
right.
form of... There's going to be administrative processes that are going to be reviewed and approved by
the City Council. The program is reviewed, not the individual
programs,
assessments.
But the programs are reviewed, and if the particular right. determinations don't comply with the programs, the City Council says...
Right, but the assessments aren't reviewed by the Common Council. That's imposed by, what, either the City Manager or the Development Director?
The assessment is a flat fee of $10,000.
Right, but whether the property owner qualifies for one of these exemptions or enters into this sort of stability agreement, which constitutes another exception if the property owner agrees to stay in the home after demolishing and rebuilding, et cetera.
I mean, right.
The Common Council doesn't make those decisions.
It made them by statute, and there is.
No, it enacted the statutory scheme, Council.
Right.
You're not getting the drift of my question.
No, I'm sorry. I apparently am missing it. They do the way that the city works is the City Council.
They don't
is
issue
the
Common Council doesn't issue the permits.
Correct.
Okay.
There's no doubt about
and,
that.
And the fee attaches to the permit.
And the fee attaches.
And those decisions are made by administrators
who are complying with the clear language of the ordinance.
Right.
There's no discretion on behalf of somebody within community development or the city manager's office whether to impose $10,000, except for the clear exceptions for the stability or if they've paid already. And
right, but that's
home.
Not the point. The point is that this is not, you know, a tax that's generally assessed for purposes of revenue raising. It's a very particularized regulatory scheme designed to provide economic incentives for certain property uses in compliance with state regulators, apparently, So it's not a, it's certainly not a quintessential tax, and it doesn't even fall within a very gray area, so far as I can see.
It is certainly not a quintessential tax,
right,
because it's not, it doesn't fall upon everybody. But if you think about it, taxes don't necessarily fall upon anybody, even income tax, property taxes, two of the most common taxes. They don't fall upon every single person. You may not pay income tax. You may not pay property tax. Here, by the plaintiff's own admissions in the complaint, half of the city of Evanston is subject to this tax. They estimate about 30,000 people. Population of Evanston is about 70,000 people. So about half of the people of Evanston are subject to this tax. Now, when you look at a regulatory scheme, you think, what is the person who's paying the fee, paying the tax, what are they getting in return? Here they're getting a permit, but they're not getting a service in return. It's not that sort of quintessential fee system. It is within that gray area. It's certainly not an easy question at either end of the spectrum. But if you look at the purpose of it, which is to raise money, and it does raise money, and it raised $150,000, I don't know of a single case that says $150,000 is not a substantial amount of money. You compare that to the two cases where they do talk about how much money is raised. Hager, $20, which could have been zero.
What period of time was this in which the money was raised?
Between June 4th, 2007, and May of 2008, for about 17 months.
Are there any other sources of funds available for this affording housing fund other than the demolition program?
The state of Illinois provides funding, and I'm not sure if HUD does as well.
I see. There probably are other ways that you can fill that account besides this demolition permit.
I'm not so sure, Judge. The last time I checked, the state of Illinois was, I think, $17 billion in debt. So,
well, Evanston could allocate general revenues to this purpose without having this regulatory scheme, right? There's nothing that prevents you from doing that.
There is certainly nothing that prevents Evanston from increasing some other form of tax, but then wouldn't that be challenged, saying there's no relationship between the tax and the ultimate purpose, and it would get challenged under the Illinois Uniformity Clause in its constitution, saying there's no nexus between the tax and the ultimate spending of money, which is exactly why this tax...
You don't need that if you're just going to fold it into the general revenues of the city and put it on the property tax.
Well, property tax is...
Right. I mean, if it's a programmatic function of the city to have an affordable housing program like this, the city could finance it out of general property tax revenues without any state constitutional problems, right?
Well, property tax revenues go into specific buckets within the municipal code. I don't know if this would fall within that particular statutory framework.
This gets back to the social engineering thing. If you want to change the practice of way people deal with their property, that wouldn't work. But Judge Sykes suggested general property tax.
The goal is to raise revenue. I mean, that is the ultimate goal of the tax. And the hope of raising that revenue is that you get more affordable housing in Evanston so that it remains Evanston. Evanston is what Evanston is. People move there because it has that unique flavor to it. I'm not sure if you've been to Evanston recently, but it has its own unique character, and diversity is part of Evanston. And that's why the city council imposed this tax. And again, it's not the administration of the tax. It's who imposes the tax. If I could just briefly address the standing question. It appears that they're arguing that they're standing to challenge the Tax Injunction Act because they don't have a federal forum. Well, that's not a constitutional violation. It's not a violation of any kind. If that were a violation, there could be no diversity jurisdiction, and we know that that's certainly proper. And then going back to Judge Ripple's question, they specifically testified in their depositions. They have no intent whatsoever to sell this property. And it wasn't necessarily because the economy's gone south or the real estate market has collapsed. They have no intent. Now, they did come back and say there is that component, but there's nothing there. Their complaint
I think that overstates the record. We have an affidavit from a buyer that the plaintiffs had an agreement with to sell the property to who wanted to flip it. And the existence of this tax scotched the deal. It was the specific reason why the deal didn't go through. That seems to me to be a concrete injury, apart from this broader injury of the demolition tax operating as a continuing encumbrance on the plaintiff's property rights.
I see that my time's up. Would you like me to address that?
Yes.
I thought so. There is the declaration of Mr. Hutton within there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it specifically says he's going to then redevelop it or not, but what Mr.
He says he's a real estate developer.
They sit on property all the time.
It was my intention to demolish the structure on the property and build a new single-family dwelling.
Well, there's the answer. In the deposition testimony, which is subsequent to that, both Mr. Cathrine and his wife say they have no intent to sell the property. Now, if they're seeking declaratory injunctive relief, and that's a classic Lyons issue, that there's no damage. And then if it's an issue of where can they sue, that's redressability, which is the point I think you were making, Judge, is that, well, you can go to state court and you can file your claims there, and there's your redressability to challenge these underlying matters.
All right, and that argument goes to the standing for the standalone constitutional challenge to the Tax Injunction Act, but the property rights injury that they have asserted here provides support for standing for the other claims that go directly to the constitutionality of the Demolition Act.
I don't think there's so for the declaratory or injunctive relief because of their deposition testimony they don't intend to do it. If this case boils down to Mr. Cathrine claiming that he wants $10,000, well, maybe we can just make an offer of judgment to him and we'd be done with this litigation. If you have no further questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Vitreva, we gave your opponent a little extra time. We'll give you two more minutes.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate that. I would like to address some issues that were raised in response. First of all, the ordinance here does vest the director of Evanston's Community Development Department with discretion. The text does not apply in the following instances. If the director determines, pursuant to regulations enacted by the City Council, that the building or structure replacing the building or structure that is the subject of the demolition permit constitutes affordable housing. So that's one point, the director discretion. Second, in Section 422.4, tax deferral option, the person requesting to defer the payment shall make application for deferral to the director of the Community Development Department, and the subsequent Section Stability Incentive, which is basically allowing for reimbursement of the tax that was paid, also directs all residents to make applications to the director on the form provided for that purpose. Second, there are other ways to maintain or to fund the affordable housing initiatives in the state act. The state statute, which defendants state provides the basis for the demolition ordinance here, the Affordable Housing Planning and Appeal Act, that's an Illinois state statute, it sets the goal of providing and preserving affordable housing and specifically mentions that municipalities are authorized to accept donations of money and land in the trusts, and it also authorizes municipalities to use their zoning powers to forward those purposes. The statute does not expressly mention the taxing powers of municipalities, does not expressly authorize to tax for these purposes. So, in Hager, this court noted that the state authority that the municipality invoked was more in the nature of a regulatory authority rather than taxing, a statutory authority involving taxing powers. And also, just on a general point, the argument here municipalities have very broad regulatory powers. There is nothing wrong with it. There is nothing bad about it. It just means that in this particular case, that the district court, you know, get to address the constitutionality, the claims of the plaintiffs on the merits. And we're not talking about, you know, the, you know, what this decision might be. It's a neutral, in a sense, ruling on that matter. It's just that the Tax Injunction Act doesn't apply and the district court get to address the plaintiff's constitutional claims with respect to the constitutionality of the ordinance at issue here on the merits. So there is, you know, no negative connotation to that ruling as to the character of enactment by the city of Evanston.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.